The Brian McClanahan Show, episode 295.
It's time to think locally and act locally. Welcome to the Brian McClanahan Show.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. Glad to have you back in the program. Very glad to be here. Don't forget to follow me on Twitter, at Brian McClanahan. Like my Facebook page, at Brian McClanahan. And of course, subscribe to my YouTube page, where you can watch this podcast, at Brian McClanahan. You'll find all those social media accounts on my webpage, brianmcclanahan.com. That's B-R-I-O-N, McClanahan.com. While you're there, give me an email address, and I'll give you a free ebook, Forgotten Founders, and a free audiobook of the same title read by yours truly. You can support the show by going to McClanahanacademy.com. It's always free to enroll. You get a free class when you do so. Just check your email or click on that 10 Myths of American History. That is my free course, a gift to you. But I do have courses available for purchase. It's a great way to support the show and get something awesome out of it at the same time. And those that do enroll in McClanahan Academy do get the best deals on forthcoming courses. And if you're listening to this before the middle of March 2020, I have a new course coming out at that point. So you're going to want to get that. You're going to know about it first, and you're going to get the best deal on it if you are a McClanahan Academy subscriber. So go on out and do that. You can also support the show by going to brianmcclanahan.com/support. You can donate monthly, or you can give me a one-time gift, whatever you want to do. Throw a few pennies my way, help keep the lights on, help keep the podcast going. You also got a way to purchase book plates. So if you want my autograph on one of my books, just buy one of those book plates. I'll autograph it, send it out to you. Great way to support the show. Also, you can go to brianmcclanahan.com and click on that shop tab. You can get all your Brian McClanahan Show apparel. It's a great way to advertise and a great way to support the show. And go to LearnTrue, T-R-U-E, LearnTrueHistory.com. That is my affiliate link for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom, another great way to support the show and get something great out of it as well. So lots of great ways to support the show. Always, though, share it around on social media. Rate it on your favorite podcast website, wherever that is. That way more people will see it and more people will be thinking locally and acting locally. Organic growth is the best growth. And if you want to submit a request for a show, send it my way. I want you to make the show better. Remember that requests have to be something I can talk about over about 30 minutes, not just something that would take me 5 minutes to answer. It's got to be a substantial request. So I do read everything you send my way. I may not respond, but I do read them. So I want you to make the show better. If you go to anchor.fm, you can also leave a voice message if you want to get on the show. You can do it that way as well. Lots of great ways to interact with the show and get in touch with me. So please do that. I enjoy reading your emails. Okay, let's talk about the topic of the day, which is the 1776 Project. So the 1619 Project, which I addressed in a previous episode, has now spawned the 1776 Project. This is the quote-unquote conservative reaction to the 1619 Project. So it was bound to happen. I mean, the 1619 Project, for all the bad things about it, I will say this, it has been an important watershed in at least popular history. I mean, it started a discussion that I don't personally think needed to be had, but it has. And so you can say, at least positive for the people that were involved in that, they've done what they sought out to do, which is get people talking about their work. I did it one time. I also wrote a piece for Chronicles Magazine for it because I was asked. But I think the project would just go away if people would ignore it. Now, unfortunately, it's also the goal of the project is also to get the 1619 Project, to get the material into school curriculum. So that's where it could be problematic overall, long term. But of course, the 1776 Project has now been produced, and the goal of it, as it says in this piece I'm going to read about it, is a nonpartisan black-led response to the 1619 Project initiative. Excuse me. So this is a quote-unquote nonpartisan. Now, you see, here is the problem with all of this. The 1619 Project is partisan. It's influenced by political ideas. It's influenced by a reading of history. So is the 1776 Project. It's also partisan and influenced by a particular reading of history. There isn't any objective history. It's a myth. And I've talked about that on this podcast as well. There is no objective history. It does not exist. The problem with history is that most people don't admit their biases up front. So by the 1776 Project saying this is nonpartisan, this is objective. No, it's not. It's not at all. You have an agenda. You're trying to refute the 1619 Project. It's based on your understanding of history and your reading of it, which is a Lincolnian reading of history. So that's your perspective. You are being colored by your understanding of history. The same thing with the 1619 Project. These people have an agenda. It's based on their understanding of what they've read in history, their worldview, which is victimhood. And so they're going to write a series of essays based on victimhood. It's simple as that. The problem is we don't admit this stuff up front. Now, if you're astute enough, you can read into it and say, well, yeah, these are what these people are. If you read enough history, it becomes very clear from the beginning what these people are. And one of the things that I was always charged with doing when I was an undergraduate and graduate student by good professors was figuring out who these people were that were writing these books. For example, if you know Eric Foner is a communist, which he is, you're going to understand that everything he writes comes with a communist worldview. There's only one book that he's ever produced that doesn't have that worldview, and that's his Free Soil, Free Labor, Free Men. And that's because Eugene Genovese had a heavy hand in that particular book. Now, Genovese was also a communist, but Genovese, when that book was produced, but Genovese was a bit different in that he was certainly a communist in the 1970s, but he was interested more in a non-ideological history. He was honest in many ways. And so that particular book is at least honest. So, and I will say Foner's The Second Founding is honest in what happened during Reconstruction. I mean, there are things about Eric Foner where he's right, okay? But you know when you read Eric Foner what you're getting. And that's the important thing. You know, for example, when you read Forrest MacDonald, what you're getting. He's a Hamiltonian. But at least he was honest when he wrote his book on Jefferson. I mean, Forrest MacDonald is a conservative historian. You know what you're getting. This is the where understanding who these historians are makes sense. And for the 1776 Project to say it's nonpartisan, it's a joke. That's a joke. You don't have objective history. There's a book by a man named Novick entitled That Noble Dream, looking for a subtitle of something like The Search for Historical Objectivity or something like that. But anyways, Novick pointed out that all of these people who have written American history, I mean, it's all biased. And he went through private letters and other things. So everything we look at is biased. And what we often do, what we gravitate towards as historians or as laymen, if you're just out there reading history and, oh, I want to read about that, you gravitate towards people that think like you, that validate your positions. This is when, you know, something I'll say about Rush Limbaugh. He said this when I used to listen to Limbaugh, but he was right about this. All he did was just validate what people already thought. He's out there talking and he's validating what people think. Now, it doesn't mean people aren't persuaded and come over to that side based on listening to Limbaugh, or reading this history, or reading this newspaper, or whatever the case may be, listening to this show, listening to Tom Woods, whatever you listen to, wherever you're influenced by, it doesn't mean you can't come around to certain positions because of that. But you often find and seek out the things that validate what you believe already. And so the 1619 Project is for those that already believe these positions. So look, they've done what they sought out to do, which is get a conversation based on their positions. They've established the playing field, which is entirely wrong. In the essay I wrote for Chronicles Magazine, which is behind a paywall, so I'm not going to do much with it at this particular time, or at least talk much about it. But I do get into the 1619 Project and why I think the project is absolute. First, and I'll just say this, the main premise of the 1619 Project is that all of this stuff that they're talking about is never taught in schools. And I point out in the essay that I wrote for Chronicles that this is completely false. Historians talk about these things all the time. In fact, it's not just historians, but you are bombarded with this particular narrative from the time you get to elementary school in America. And I show this by several different means. One is there are a survey conducted in the early 2000s of high school students and adults where they asked them to pick the most important Americans. And I mentioned this in my book, Politically Incorrect Guide to Real American Heroes, where they ask these individuals to pick important Americans. You can't pick presidents. You can't pick the wife of the president. So who are the people they pick? Harriet Tubman, Martin Luther King. These are the people that are chosen. And in places like Indiana, which is predominantly white, those individuals are chosen more than in diverse areas of the country. So if this stuff isn't being taught in school, if we're being taught that, if we're not being taught slavery, we're not being taught segregation, if that's the case, then why would all of these things be happening? I mean, these are the people that anyone knows about. We've had countless movies about slavery. Uncle Tom's Cabin is one of the most important books of all time. People are required to read this thing all the time. So how is it that this narrative is not being taught? I'm confused about the entire premise that somehow Americans don't understand that slavery was a part of American history, or that segregation was a part of American history. It's all over the place. We're bombarded with it on a regular basis. Roots, the miniseries Roots, which came out in the 1970s, had one of the most watched finales. Not just that, the series itself was one of the most watched series of all time on television. I mean, to say that people didn't get this stuff is just an absolutely ridiculous statement to begin with. I mean, it doesn't even make any sense. On the other hand, you won't get the counter to that. For example, we're going to read Uncle Tom's Cabin, but no one's ever assigned Nehemiah Adams' book on his travels in the South during the 1850s and what he found in the South. He actually set out, here's an abolitionist from New England who set out to prove Uncle Tom's Cabin. He travels to the South and he writes this book entitled The South Side of Slavery. And it's nothing like Uncle Tom's Cabin. In fact, he was excoriated for this book. William Lloyd Garrison called it a piece of vile trash or something like that. I mean, he hated this thing. Why? Because it refuted everything the abolitionists were saying in the North. So here's an abolitionist who goes to the South and says, well, wait a second, y'all have never even been down there. How do you write stories about the South and you've never really even been there? So, but no one's going to read that particular book. You see, so we don't get both sides. We don't have a balanced view of the issue. The most important books written on slavery in America are Eugene Genovese's Roll, Jordan, Roll and Fogel and Engerman's Time on the Cross. And while neither one is complimentary of slavery, and rightly so, they provide a much more complex look at the institution. In fact, Fogel and Engerman were, again, just excoriated in the 1970s for writing a book that happened to say, well, wait a second here, the evidence doesn't really show what we're saying about the institution. So this is the issue we run into with things like the 1619 Project. There's a whole other side to these things that doesn't get addressed. The 1776 Project is bad because it's based on the same premise as the 1619 Project. Namely, that these things don't get discussed enough. But yet, we're going to do it in a different way. We're going to do it in a conservative way. We're going to do it in a Lincolnian Gettysburg Address way. That the entire United States is based on the proposition that all men are created equal. And so, therefore, we're going to agree with the 1619 Project, essentially, that this is the foundation of America, and yet Americans strove to meet that ideal all the time. It's false to say that Americans didn't. Now, even the 1619 Project actually says this, that they just say it's black Americans that held onto this ideal the most. And if you believe in the proposition nation, if you believe that's what the United States was founded on, then I actually can agree with the 1619 Project in that way. I mean, the 1776 Project essentially says the exact same thing. If you believe America was a proposition nation, that it began in a certain period of time, then you have to essentially come to this conclusion. Of course, I would say America is not a proposition nation. It never was a proposition nation. Lincoln invented American history at Gettysburg, in the Gettysburg Address in 1863. He invented these things. This is the whole key to understanding why both the 1619 Project and the 1776 Project are entirely wrong. But to get into why, I'm going to take a quick break for a second. I'm going to see you on the other side of this. I'll be right back, and I'll get into the full details of why I believe this in this particular essay on the 1776 Project. I'll see you then. Let me talk to you for a minute about McClanahan Academy. I know at the beginning of this particular podcast or this video, I talked about McClanahan Academy. But let me go into a little more detail about why I think you should sign up for it and why I created it. First, a little bit about me. I have a PhD in American history from the University of South Carolina, and I've taught in the college environment for 20 years. And I've seen college students get worse over time, the curriculum get worse, and students are being indoctrinated more than educated now in our higher education system, whether it's high school or college. So I wanted a counterweight to that. And this is why I created the McClanahan Academy. Now, first, it's always free to enroll at McClanahan Academy. You sign up, it's free. And I give you a free course, 10 Myths of American History, when you do sign up. So it's a great way to get an introduction to what I do, but I've got 8 courses for sale there and more forthcoming. All of these courses are designed to give you the non-PC version of American history, to take the red pill, so to speak. And I've got 2 courses in particular, my U.S. History Survey courses, which are designed for homeschoolers. So if you're a homeschooler and you want a good curriculum, and my family has homeschooled all of our children from the beginning, and you want a solid history curriculum, that's why I designed the United States History 1865 and 1865 the present. You've got enough material, you've got lesson plans, you've got tests, you've got reading material, you've got reading seminars, you've got 36 weeks, if you take them, buy them both, you've got 36 weeks of material, and it can be used as a high school history curriculum, or if you're just a lifelong learner, you can use it otherwise. But it's a great way to get a real history education devoid of Marxism and progressivism and political correctness. So sign up at McClanahanAcademy.com. That's McClanahanAcademy.com. Again, always free to enroll, and I'll see you there. All right, we're back talking about this 1776 Project and the 1619 Project and how both are actually pretty bad, but I want to get into this piece that was published on Quillette on the 1776 Project. And it begins, it begins with stating why they wrote this thing. So the author says, from my perspective as a member, 1776 has 3 core goals: rebutting some outright historical inaccuracies in the 1619 Project. Okay, I mean, I think that's an important thing to do. And there's essentially 2 major essays in that project that are problematic. The first essay, which is nothing but political partisan nonsense, and the essay on the influence of slavery on capitalism. I mean, what's interesting about that, of course, is was slavery capitalistic or not? This is where you get into the Fogel-Engerman v. Genovese argument. And these 2 people are still important. Right, in that particular, was slavery ultra-capitalist or was it paternalist? I mean, which one was it? Is paternalism capitalism? And you get into all these different nuances. And I think that now you're getting into the weeds, and this just people's eyes gloss over and it goes over their head. So just by saying slavery created capitalism, well, that's a sharp thing to say without any basis whatsoever. And people, oh yeah, well, I mean, capitalism is exploitative, slavery is exploitative, so therefore slavery and capitalism go hand in hand. But this is where you get into just simply platitudes and slogans and what that means for history. Number 2, discussing tragedies like slavery and segregation honestly, while clarifying that these were not the most important historical foundations of the United States. And 3, presenting an alternative inspirational view of the lessons of our nation's history to Americans of all races. So the essay gets into people like Gordon Wood and John Oakes and others who have said that the project is awful. And I mean, look, Gordon Wood is one of the most important American historians. John Oakes has written quite a bit about Abraham Lincoln, and I have a lot of negative things to say about John Oakes. And he takes issue with it because, of course, Nicole Hannah Jones drags Abraham Lincoln through the mud. And you can't do that. You can't say that Lincoln was bad. No, because that's taking down the American demigod. But I think that in that particular case, as I've said, and there's some things that are right about the 1619 Project. You know, and of course, John Oakes says, you know, you can't do this. Wood, the essay says, points out that attributing American secession to a desire to protect slavery rather than, say, taxation without representation, conflicts over French and Indian War debt, or tense arms exchanges like the Boston Massacre makes the Revolution out to be like the Civil War, which is wrong in so many ways. Now, I've mentioned this before. I mean, look, there were people that said the war was about slavery at the time. I mean, the British tried to make it so in both New York and Virginia. They did try. And the fact that when Washington presided over the British withdrawal from New York and he wanted the slaves that the British had acquired and freed left in New York, and New York said, the British said no, and they sent these slaves to Canada, that was a major problem for Washington and for the Americans because this was contraband in their mind. So you could say slavery was certainly part of this thing. I mean, I don't think you're being an honest historian by not saying that. I, of course, think the American War for Independence was a constitutional crisis over the powers of the center in relation to the powers of the local. I mean, look, at its heart, this is what it was. It was a dispute. As John Dickinson pointed out, look, you can regulate our trade, but you cannot regulate our internal affairs, and this is what you're doing. Dickinson is the penman of the Revolution. You can't regulate our internal affairs. And this is by nature what we're talking about here. This is when you have the Suffolk Resolves and other things getting involved in that. I mean, you're saying in Massachusetts, they're saying, look, we're just going to nullify your unconstitutional laws. It's a constitutional crisis. And you could say that there's taxes they're dealing with, there's debt, there's current, and all these things are symptoms of the larger disease, which is a constitutional crisis. Wood says, I was surprised by the scope of this thing, since it's going to become the basis for high school education and has the weight of the New York Times behind it. Now, the author of this piece says, I will note that my recent book, Taboo, 10 Facts You Can't Talk About, makes the same point at some length, pointing out that quite a few contemporary black problems have very little to do with slavery. For example, the black rate of illegitimate out-of-wedlock childbirths was 11% in 1938, barely 70 years after slavery ended, but today hovers around 74%. And the illegitimacy rate today is approximately 35% for American whites. The welfare policies of the 1960s, frankly, have been a greater cause of this multicolored social issue than radicalized oppression 150 years ago. I mean, he's right about this. Look, when you create a welfare state and you create a nanny state, well, it takes away personal responsibility. And so nobody has any personal responsibility for anything anymore, whether it's preparing for an economic downturn because they just think they'll get unemployment, whether it's preparing for retirement, you just get Social Security, whether it's preparing for having kids, you just get welfare, Medicaid, whatever you need to take care of the kids. I mean, this is what people think now. Now, on the other hand, part of this is also driven by economic problems in that we have extensive inflation. We have Hamiltonian system, which has created some of the problems we see where people cannot afford unless they have two incomes, high taxes. I mean, all of this stuff creates an environment where we have a situation where people cannot afford at times to take care, even if they're working. I mean, you do have working people that are on these social services because they just can't afford it in certain areas. Of course, there are cheaper places to live. But when you live in a place like California where it's expensive to live everywhere, yeah, it's very hard to get by on a blue-collar job. And we need those jobs. I mean, so this is the thing. That type of economic problems is not created by slavery. It's created by a poor economic system, which is Hamiltonianism. is created by a Federal Reserve policy of inflation, high taxes, high spending, high debt. I mean, these are all problems where you don't get 100 cents for every dollar, right? I mean, this is a critique back in the late 19th century when people talked about inflation. You don't get 100 cents out of every dollar you earn. You get a portion of that. The essay continues, a third, at least very strategic omission that is consistent throughout almost all of the 1619 Project essays is a focus on American slavery in isolation, to the frequent exclusion of both narratives about the successful American anti-slavery movement and narratives about the far harsher slave trades conducted around the globe for most of history. This is true. I mean, look, slavery is a worldwide problem, still is to this very day. For those people that run around the United States, I'm anti-slavery, I would have been an abolitionist. Well, you have an opportunity now to be one, and most people don't. It's very convenient. It's easy to be a 21st century armchair abolitionist. How do you know you would have been an abolitionist in the 1860s? You don't know you would have been. Maybe you wouldn't have been. It was dangerous. And so why aren't you running over to Africa or Asia or Haiti or somewhere like that where slavery still exists and trying to put a stop to it there? If you're an abolitionist, you can go to it today, but most people are just going to be an armchair abolitionist. Ah, I'm an abolitionist. Wow, that's a bold statement to make in 2020. Really bold. I mean, who isn't in America in 2020? Right? This is just stupid. He says, all that said, it is not enough merely to critique an opponent's worldview. A successful movement must provide a worldview of its own. Three core elements of my view of slavery, and I think it's fair to say 1776's as well, are one, recognizing that an anti-slavery movement led by white and black people of goodwill existed in this country as long as slavery did, and won in the end. Two, recognizing that slavery did not build the USA, but rather made the prebellum South into something of a backwater, due largely to the profound and subtle resistance of the slaves themselves. Now see, this is where the project goes completely off the rails. That the first two statements, I mean, this is true. There was a substantial anti-slavery movement, but the way the essay describes it ignores something that's very important. I'll get into that in a second. And three, recognizing that America paid a adverse butcher's bill of hundreds of thousands of lives during the Civil War in order to free the slaves. So the entire premise is Lincolnian from the beginning, and it's bad history. It's bad history. The 1776 Project is as bad of history as the 1619 Project. We have one bad history refuting another bad history. First, let me just go on these premises here. Number one, anti-slavery movement led by black and white people of goodwill. The author goes out and says that this was started in New England. It's because these black former revolutionary soldiers, thousands of them in New England, led an anti-slavery movement that we had anti-slavery. And, well, over 100 of the first 130 anti-slavery societies were in the South. He also ignores the fact that Thomas Jefferson wanted to insert a anti-slavery statement into the Declaration. I mean, look, Thomas Jefferson from Virginia wanted to do this. And even though these people were anti-slavery, it didn't mean that they were not racist. I mean, Jefferson was a racist, certainly. So was George Washington. I mean, all these people were. But it also ignores that in New England itself, the pro-slavery movement actually began in New England. So New England is problematic. When you start putting New England out there saying, well, here it is. These rock-ribbed anti-slavery people in New England were behind getting slavery No, they weren't. I mean, the reason that slavery was abolished in Massachusetts is because a court decided it would be, based on the Massachusetts Constitution. This is ridiculous stuff. But it's what these people often do. And I find this highly problematic when you don't tell the whole story about what's happening with anti-slavery. And yes, Virginia was at the forefront of anti-slavery in the colonial period into the early Federal Republic. You could say that, well, but all these northern states abolished slavery. This is true, but Virginia was at the forefront of the intellectual opposition to it. And Yeah, but remember, Jefferson's the one who prohibited slavery from the Northwest Territory. So I find it odd that they would focus on New England. Again, when you look at the Southerners who became very pro-slavery in the antebellum period, they were learning in the North from Northern theological instruction, which was heavily pro-slavery. Larry Tise's book entitled Pro-Slavery, T-I-S-E, Larry Tise, Pro-Slavery, is the best book ever written on this, and everyone ignores it. Why? Because it doesn't fit the Lincolnian narrative of self-righteous Northerners and evil Southerners, which is essentially what this author does with the second point, which is to say that slavery not build the USA, but rather made the prevailing South into something of a backwater. This is completely untrue. Completely untrue. He says, even within the South, when slavery legally existed, there is little evidence that reliance on feudal serfdom made American slave states richer than their free counterparts. In fact, historian Mark Shulman points out that before the Civil War, the vast majority of industrial manufacturing and other competitive industrial work took place in the U.S. North. So what? I mean, everyone knew this, but that doesn't mean that that area is richer. Per capita, the South was richer than the North. This is why Northerners were clamoring to get to the South and own a plantation. And it happened all the time because they realized sugar production in particular, the largest and most luxurious houses in the United States were built in the 1850s around Louisiana in the sugar producing areas because they were making a lot of money. So, and I've seen, look, there's been several things done to show that Southerners actually made a lot of money on slavery and that the South is not some economic backwater. And of course, there, if you want to say it's industrialization, the South is also industrializing. One thing that's interesting, there's a book entitled Slavery in the Cities. I think that's the title of it. But it points out that slaves in Richmond Iron Works were actually paid overtime. They worked fewer hours than their white female counterparts in northern textile manufacturing. And I mean, so you get into a lot of different nuances here about what's happening with industrialization, all these things. But this is a complete garbage position. And then finally, any cost-benefit analysis of the impact of slavery on the USA would be incomplete without including the cost of freeing the slaves. In fiscal terms alone, the price tag for the Civil War was a high one. The debt went up. The deaths, of course, all of that. It says, you know, this is the cost of freeing the slaves. He says, the vision of 1776 goes far beyond disagreement with the political left about questions of historical slavery. When I talked to the project's founder, Bob Woodson, on February 3rd, he described the broader vision behind 1619 as just more of the same. Sounding quite similar to Dr. Oakes, Bob pointed out that the thesis underlying many 1619 Project essays, and arguably most arguments on the identitarian left, can be summed up as, you do not control your own life. I mean, I think this is true. Look, I mean, there is a certain victimhood about this. And so this is where the 1776 Project goes. He says, well, we at the 1776 have seen them fail. Against them, we propose a simple and positive thesis. America is a very good, if sometimes flawed, society. It is frankly not very hard to succeed here, and hard work and personal responsibility will help you do so. There have been dark periods of American history, to be sure, and it is important to discuss them honestly. Well, I mean, it would be good if you did that, too. But there have been dark periods during the centuries and millennia-long histories of virtually all human societies, and blah, blah, blah. Today, 101 years after the great lady passed, there is no excuse for promoting a kind of historical fatalism in the world's richest large society. Blacks and whites can certainly, if they choose to spend valuable time this way, debate racism and which group had it 5% easier. But can anyone seriously describe it as a Herculean task to work 5% or 10% or 20% harder than the average millennial American? This is Wilfred Riley, who's an associate professor of political science at Kentucky State University. So, again, it's kind of getting into this, you know, pull yourselves up by your bootstraps idea that, you know, you can work hard. You don't have victimhood in society. And look, I can agree with that. I can agree with that just fine. But it's based on an understanding of America that Lincoln invented in the Gettysburg Address is a proposition nation, that America was founded on the idea that all men are created equal, or as Joe Biden says, you know the thing. All men are created equal. You know the thing. you know the thing, right? So, look, America was founded in 1607 when the first Englishman set foot in Jamestown. Now, you could argue that there are, of course, Europeans here, the Spanish, the French as well. But America was founded at that point with a Anglo basis. And all the, I'll get into this in my courses on American history. There's no founding and there's no creation of America in 1770. America was already there. The 1776 was the embodiment of American culture at that point. As Jefferson said, it's an expression of the American mind. It was already there. There's no creation. There's no ideal. It was an organic, real thing. That's the difference between a creation of America or not. And I think in some ways the 1619 Project, you're going to say, well, 1619 is when America, you know, when it, but slavery was already there before 1619. So, it already existed. So if you want to say, well, that's, you know, it has nothing to do with an ideal. It has everything to do with concrete examples. Well, I mean, I can buy that too. So the 1776 Project is also bad history in many ways. It should be avoided just like the 1619 Project. But people have asked me to talk about this thing. So it made for a good podcast. We could do this in more detail and more depth over several podcasts. But I wanted to at least hit the highlights and explain where I thought some of the problems with it were. And where they largely resided in this opening essay in defense of it. So, hope you enjoyed this episode of the Brian McClanahan Show. I'll see you next time.